Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. I'm Larry Mishkin of Mishkin Law in Chicago, joined today by my co-host, Rob Hunt of Lanay Holdings out in San Diego, who after a few weeks away has made it back to the microphone. Rob, nice to have you back.
So good to be back. It's so nice to be back in Southern California, where my internet works, and everything seems to be working back in the home office. So very pleased to be around and ready to talk weed and the Grateful Dead.
Wonderful. We have a great show today, August 22nd, 1993, from Autzen Stadium. We call that, you know, more recent Dead. A year maybe when the Dead weren't at their finest, but occasionally shown through, and this is certainly one of them. Dan, why don't you kick us off with our opening musical clip here, and we'll just let everybody listen to it, and we'll talk about it afterwards. I'm going to let you talk about that one. That's great stuff. What do you got for us?
Yeah, look, I mean, the reason I picked the 822-93 from Autzen, as you said, you know, not necessarily known as the Grateful Dead's best year, but there was something about this night, there was something about that venue, and you know, one of the cool things about this one, the reason I picked the Slipknot to kick us off, is it was really the first time that Garcia was playing on a new guitar that affectionately is known as Lightning Bolt, which is the first guitar that he'd been playing for probably the last, you know, previous 15 years. He'd been on Doug Irwin's guitars. He'd been on Wolf and Tiger and Rosebud. But he met this guy named Stephen Kripe at a show, I want to say, in Florida a few years before. And Kripe was not a guitar maker, but decided that he wanted to make Garcia a guitar. He was a great woodworker and decided to have a go at it and created something that he basically watched the movie So Far over and over and over again to see kind of if he could figure out what the weight of the guitar was and what the shape of the guitar was that, you know, Garcia liked so much that Irwin did, and tried to recreate something that he would like, and then picked out woods, you know, that were like Brazilian woods, so it had the rainforest sort of connotation to it, and really cool inlays and really, really nice, you know, body. But this is a guy that I'd never really tried before, and, you know, Garcia got it and was so impressed. I think his quote was, "This is the guitar I've been waiting my whole life for." But the question was, could it play? You know, it was beautiful. But when he first got the guitar, he played it one night and then sent it back to be completely revamped for a period of time. And the first night that he got it back after the revamping was for 822-93. So this is really the one where, you know, we got to see what, you know, this new guitar could do. And the Slipknot I picked because it's just, it gives a really good sense of the sound of Kripe's new guitar, of Garcia's new guitar. And, you know, if you listen to it, it's got sort of a tinny higher end to it. It's got a much more of a different sort of twang. A lot of people say it's more of an acoustic sound than, you know, what you were getting out of Irwin's guitars. But Garcia obviously loved to play. He didn't play anything else for about the next year and a half after this night. So, you know, figured I'd kick it off with that. And, you know, what do you know about Stephen Kripe? Have you done any of the reading up on who he was or what he did?
I can't tell you that I know a whole lot. I looked into him a little bit for today's show, but here's the thing about all of it that just amazes the hell out of me. Being a woodworker has nothing to do with making a guitar. I love the fact that this guy was ballsy enough to just say, I can make a guitar. And what I saw, and what you sent over, was it's like he watched some videos. He, you know, there was no YouTube back then, right, for him to go to, so he had to make do with whatever information he could find and, you know, and basically just doing it that way. You know, he went ahead and he did it. The quote was, you know, about the guesswork that he had to make to, you know, to get it right. And this guy got it right. And I think that that's just so astounding, you know, that someone who is obviously an artisan and had great skills was able to take those skills and translate them into something. This is just my thought, but I would have to say manufacturing, you know, an instrument that's made out of wood and where the shape of the instrument is so crucial and the sound that the instrument makes, for somebody with no musical experience to be able to step in and knock the socks off of Jerry Garcia is a great story. And you know, that to me, that's just very cool that, you know, he put together. And look, if Garcia says that's all I'm going to play and he plays it so exclusively for a year and a half, you're never going to get a better endorsement than that.
Yeah, I agree. And the really cool thing is that the second he started playing this, he ordered another guitar pretty much on the spot, which Kripe actually made for him, which became known as Top Hat, which Garcia never played on stage, but he actually played at home all the time. So, you know, that was the next one that, you know, that was expected to kind of be introduced to the audience. But there's one after that. He actually produced four guitars for Garcia. And the next one is called, there's one called Saturn, and there was one called, I can't remember the other one, but the Eagle, I think. And that's the one that, like, looked a little bit different than an Irwin guitar. But by all accounts, was the next one that, you know, Jerry was planning on bringing to the stage as, like, his main guitar, which we never actually got to see, you know, him play. So it's one of those things that, you know, someone obviously has bought them out of auction now. I'm not sure who owns each of these guitars. I know that, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame did an exhibit with some of Kripe's guitars along with Doug Irwin's guitars. But, you know, someone's got that out there and has essentially the tone that was created specifically for, you know, Garcia. And if you look at the work that's done on these things, like anyone that's out there in the audience listening, just Google Stephen Kripe Garcia and take a look at what he was producing. And these things are some of the most beautiful guitars I've ever seen. And I would have loved to have gotten to hear some of these played on stage, because every single one that, you know, Jerry had between Wolf, Tiger, Rosebud, Lightning Bolt, Top Hat, etc., they all had different sounds, different tones. And I was a huge fan of Lightning Bolt. A lot of people weren't. A lot of people thought it, you know, was too tinny. But there's reasons I love this guitar, and it, you know, allowed. There's places on the fretboard that Garcia was playing that he never played on, let's say, Tiger, which is you know, anytime you can get someone to sort of step out of their comfort zone and to go into new areas, I thought was really cool. But I thought that Slipknot, you know, does a really nice job of kind of showing off the range.
It does, and it's such a fun tune. You know, I mean, it exists as a bridge number, right? I mean, it's a bridge number within which they can improvise and play around for a few minutes. But it's just basically to take us from Help on the Way to Franklin's Tower, and it, you know, it right, not unlike I Am Hydrogen for Fish. It just it is that carrier tune that takes you over. And too many times I just take it for granted, right? There's a really good Help on the Way. They get caught up in that really long jam that becomes Slipknot and eventually makes its way into Franklin's. And to me, the Slipknot is a lot of fun. I enjoy it, but I just don't have enough of a musical ear, you know, to be able to necessarily follow their patterns. And one of the things that Rob Cords from Dark Star Orchestra pointed out when he was on the show a month or two ago, and we talked about how much rehearsal they have to do before they go out on the road, and he said whenever he goes out on the road, before he goes out, one of the tunes that he spends a lot of time rehearsing is Slipknot, because over the years, the way the Dead played it changed. And depending on what era the show they're going to be covering is in, he needs to know, you know, what beat for, you know, Slipknot was the one they were using at that time. And I found that so fascinating because, again, I just didn't spend enough time appreciating, you know, the music going through there at that moment. I recognized the parts that I recognized, and the rest of it was just great Jerry jams where I'm sure I was blissed out and, you know, loving life at the moment or whatever. And but it's a great tune and it's great to hear. And it's a great example of this new guitar.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, speaking of Fish, sorry I missed you last weekend. I was hoping to make it out to Alpine to come out and hang out with you for a couple of days, but it sounds like you got a couple of fun nights out there. How are the shows?
Shows were great. And yeah, I am sorry you missed. It turned out that I had a couple of extra tickets and reached out to Rob, who I knew was on the East Coast, eventually heading back to the West Coast, and Chicago's right in the middle of everything. So we kept our fingers crossed. He could not make it, but I wound up with great company. My good buddy Kevin drove me up there one night, got me my seat, so I sat next to him all three nights, got me my VIP parking passes. So every night we were out of Alpine Valley within 10 minutes and on the road. So Kevin, huge shout out to you, man. You're the best. My son was there, although he was hanging out with the rest of his crew up on the lawn. They're big guys going up to sit, you know, on the blanket up on the lawn. And Kevin is like me. That's all nice. We'll come see you at halftime. But for the show, baby, I want to be under the roof and, you know, feel the energy coming back out towards me. And just one other quick shout out I have to give. The very first night we got a pavilion pass. So we had the same seat for all three nights. So, which was fine, but you got to know the people around you really well because they were the same people basically for all three nights. And right at the end of our seats on our row, the next group of seats was held down by a group made up of Tara, her boyfriend Phil, Jerry, Jackie, a guy named Lucas, I think. All of them, they were all really cool. And the first night was Tara's 100th fish show, so she was really psyched. And I was telling her, I'm just psyched because it's a fish show. And but, you know, they were there the second night, the third night, and that's kind of the fun. You know, I really missed that from The Grateful Dead, where you'd go to a show and you could be sitting next to somebody, and the next thing, they're your best buddy. And anytime you see them there or at any other show, you know, you've got that connection. And so they were all really cool, and we're hoping to bump into Tara and Phil and maybe more of them at Sacred Rose in a couple of weeks. And if you guys are listening, great to hang out with you. Tara, killer 100th show. Look, you know, I as I was telling you before, I'm at that stage of being a fish head where, you know, it gets dangerous because I know a lot of the songs now. So when you get to know the songs, you know, you start to order them in your mind in terms of, well, I'd really like to hear this one. I really like to hear that one. And as any deadhead knows, it gets really dangerous when you go to a show, you know, really counting on the fact you're going to hear the song you want and that they're going to be on that same wavelength. When it happens, it's wonderful. When it doesn't, you know, it can be frustrating. But nevertheless, what I find about fish that I like so much is even when they would dive into a song that I really wasn't quite ready for, I really didn't know that well, or about a third of the way through, he's jamming so hard, they're all jamming so hard, and the crowd is screaming so loud that you're like, this is just great. And, you know, and you just roll with it. And you know, right from the get-go on this first night of August 12th, the Friday night, with Fuego coming out and opening, and a Halley's Comet, which, after the first time I heard it, and I couldn't figure out for the life of me how any song could just have one lyric repeated 50 times in a row, I now find that I enjoy the tune very much, and the jamming that comes off of it is a lot of fun. I'm a big fan of Destiny Unbound and the MoMA dance. I really like,
and the nonsense lyrics at the end
of the MoMA dance.
No, of Haley's. There's that whole nonsense, like, you know, the plates of spaghetti and the you know.
Right. No, you're exactly right, and I mean all those lyrics when you stop and you listen to them are kind of nutty, but. Like every other song with Fish, what ultimately happens is the music wins me over so much that, you know, the lyrics, to me, just become more of a time placement thing in terms of where in the song they are. I mean, some of them are silly. I think Sleeping Monkey is a lot of fun. I love those lyrics. I was hoping to see that. I didn't. I like the lyrics in NICU. I was hoping to see that. I didn't. I was hoping to catch a You Enjoy Myself, and I didn't catch that. But on the other hand, you know, I got an Ass Handed, which was great, from John. I got a Golden Age, which is a great tune that I've always loved. Ghost is always a great one from them. A really good David Bowie. And then for the encores is where it really paid off for me. I got my first Lizards ever. So I was very happy to catch my first Lizards. And Tara was very happy to see Lizards on her 100th show. And then just to really put a capper on it, they jumped into More, which was a song that had been on my list of songs that I knew I had heard before, but I hadn't really appreciated them at the time, so I was hoping I would hear it. And we got that, so that was tremendous fun. The Saturday night show, my wife came up and joined me, and look, I kind of felt like the night I was at the Den, they played St. Stephen, right? You know something special is happening, but you really can't gauge the level of how special it is, and they came open up with 1999, into Fluffhead and into Sod Again. And I'm going to turn that over to you, Rob, to explain the significance of those tunes coming in that order.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is where, again, we turn into real nerds on the show. And, you know, anyone that's out there listening might just be like, what are you guys talking about? But 1999 is obviously the Prince song, not the Fish song. And, you know, the significance of it is, if you ask most, you know, Fish fans what the all-time greatest Fluffhead was, they would tell you, like, without a doubt, it was Alpine Valley 1999. So, you know, here they are back in Alpine Valley, and so they open up the show with the 1999 and then go into Fluffhead, sort of to recreate, like, hey, you know, we're paying homage to the fact that we know the best Fluffhead we ever played was here in 1999, and then play Saw It Again afterwards, which is like, you know, all right, we saw Fluffhead here in 1999, and you just saw it again. So, I mean, and by the way, Fish is one of the only bands that's that creative. They've always done that for the third night of Dick's Sporting Goods during Labor Day weekend, where, you know, they'll spell things out and you've got to try to figure out what the message is. But, you know, this is one that was more more subtle, that, you know, if you didn't sort of catch what they were doing. But, you know, it's one of those things, whenever anyone ever talks about Alpine 99, the first thing that comes out of people's mouths is like, oh, yeah, the Fluffhead. Like, that was the Fluffhead. So it's really clever way for them to acknowledge that that the fans loved that version so much.
Yeah, and you know, this is where, you know, just being kind of a newbie, you know, fish head term in terms of the knowledge really comes into play. I knew that they had covered Prince tunes before, and I just assumed this was another example of them covering Prince tunes. And then all of a sudden, Tara and Phil and that whole crew and Kevin and no, man, they don't play this very often. This is only like the third or fourth time they've ever played it. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that's kind of fun to catch a rarity like that. And I, you know, my feeling about Fluffhead is I realize it's a great fit. You know, the fish heads all love it. It's their big tune. I listen to it. I like the tune a lot. I don't quite get the whole this is the tune of tunes, but I don't have to. I just enjoy it for what it is. And, you know, it's silly. It's great, well played, and everybody has a great time when they play it. So why the fuck not, right? That's and Saw It Again, I had never heard before, but, you know, in the context in which you're describing it, it certainly makes sense to do it. There was a great Back on the Train, a Petrichor, and then right at the end of the set, right when everybody was thought for sure they were heading off and some people were already on their way out to the bathroom, a Trey turned around and jumped into Squirming Coil. And I really like Squirming Coil, but what I really like about it is at the end when Page is on the stage by himself playing, and he had about a 5-minute piano solo out there where he was just teasing Everything Under the Sun. He was teasing Loving Cup. According to the write-up, he was supposedly teasing the theme from the Speed Racer show, although I can't say that I heard that. But I think that with Trey right out in front doing all of his stuff, that sometimes, at least for me, I can't speak for other fish heads, it's kind of easy to overlook the level of talent that a guy like Page brings to the table. And, you know, as a trained musician who, I mean, who really is knows exactly what he's doing, and he handled it beautifully. It was beautiful music. And you know what I love is that the fish heads gave him like three standing ovations in the middle of it, and he would stop and, you know, acknowledge and thank you, and then go right back and play, and they'd be right, and they love him. You know, it was like when you'd get a great solo from Brent or something, and the Dead fans would, you know, erupt, and, you know, because we're always so focused on Jerry and Bobby, or in this case Trey and, you know, and John to a lesser, Mike Gordon to a lesser degree. You know, it was fun to see that. It was fun to see, you know, Page get his moment in the sun. And I thought that went really well. Second set, we got a really killer Maze, which if I had heard it before, I couldn't remember. A Mr. Completely, which I'm a novice enough to say I had no idea how rare that tune is. And everybody loved that. An About to Run, which my son was dead set on seeing, and he got to see it. And that was a fun tune. We really enjoyed it. And what's kind of strange, though, the second night, the first night they played well past 11 o'clock, and my friend Kevin was explaining to me, you know, at Alpine Valley, they hit you big with money for every minute over your allotted time that you play. But that first night, they sure didn't seem to care. The second night, they ended the set at 10:45, the second set, came right back out and played a really, really great version of Blaze On, but they were done at 10:55 and walked off. So everybody said, oh, Trey's getting ready for, you know, he's getting ready for Sunday night, and this is going to be the killer. So we all went back on Sunday night. The whole crowd was there again. They opened up with Landlady, and my son was not there Sunday night. He had to fly back to Boston. But right away, he's following the song list, and I get a text. This is what they opened up Sunday night in 2019, the night that was, you know, their big bust out night a few years ago. So again, I have to believe that's just Fish giving a shout out to the fact that when they were there in 2019 on Sunday night, they opened with Landlady and played an amazing show, you know, and everybody was totally psyched to hear it. And after that, it seemed, you know, a little more standard Fish to me, right? Runaway Jim, Divided Sky, 46 Days, Stealing Time from the Faulty Plan. And then they closed the set with a really great Everything's Right, which is another tune I've really liked. But I kept talking to the guys around me, and the tune I finally settled on that I really needed to hear was Possum. And I've heard Possum before, but I've never really heard it and appreciated it. And the second set, you know, opened with Energy and Dagata Jaboo, which is a great song I love. Soul Planet, not bad. Rift Reba, standard stuff. Martian Monster, which is one of those things, me personally, I wish they would just not play. But this is fun. At the end of the Martian Monster, John did a broken heart attack solo where he ran around the stage 5 times, wound up in front singing with Trey back on the drums. And I had no idea that Trey knew how to play the drums, and he was playing the drums, as you know, and having a great time. They were just having fun, and as they were winding down out of that, as Fishman got back to the drums, he started the percussion beat into Possum, and all the guys around me who had been hearing me talk about it were like, dude, here's your Possum. And you know, when you're looking for a song all night, all weekend, and they finally give it to you, they didn't disappoint. It was a killer Possum, and it was a lot of fun. Slave to the Traffic Light, great closer, And then the encores were Waste, which I didn't know very well, but that's my buddy Kevin's. That was his first dance to that tune when he and his wife got married. And First Tube. And I love First Tube. I thought that was a great song. If I had heard it before again, I had no recollection of having heard it before. And, you know, as Jonathan Schwartz would say, and that, my friends, is how you fish. But I won't steal his line. It was a great time. It was, you know, three great nights of high energy rock and roll. And, you know, the crowd just couldn't appreciate it more. And everybody was really psyched. And I hadn't been to a three-night run in Alpine Valley like that in years. So, you know, there was definitely some stamina challenges for me. But, you know, we survived and made it all the way through. And like I say, I had a great group of friends who were up there to stay with me and give me rides. My buddy Kevin drove me up. My buddy Rob drove me home through some totally unknown bucolic route late at night through Wisconsin with all the cornfields blowing in the breeze. And it was a lot of fun. So I know that back in the day you were quite the aficionado, as it were, and I'm certainly much more of a late comer to the game, but I can tell you, you know, I'm still not doing a lot of traveling for them, but anytime they're near me, I don't see how you can't go see them. They're just too much fun.
Yeah, I can tell you that you just named a lot of songs that you got to see that my children would love to, because Teddy just asked Possum to put on his Instagram playlist that my wife tried to resist, and he forced it on her, saying, no, I want Possum on there. And my daughter's put both Fluffhead and Haley's Comet on hers. So, you know, with my daughters, it's all mixed in with, like, pop tunes these days. You know, it's a lot of, like, you know, you name the pop star as well as, like, all the kids' bop stuff. But then she has a couple of Fish tunes on there. And Teddy's a handful, but he begged for Possum. And my wife's just like, come on, I don't have to listen to this in the car all the time. And he's like, no, Possum, I want Possum. So it's not just you that's waiting for his Possum.
That's what turned me on to that. I remember on Christmas, right, we were emailing back and forth, and I was telling you, my wife's out of the house for a little while. I'm sitting here listening to the Who Do Tommy live from, you know, one of the festivals at the Isle of Wight Festival. And you say, oh, well, my son and I, the wife's out of the house, we've got a full-blown Possum going, and we're all dancing around. And I was like, Possum, huh? And after that, I started going back and listening to it. I was like, I am ready for this, man. Let's go. Bring it on. And you know, it's just like that feeling of being at the Dead show. I remember when I caught my first Scarlet Fire and just how excited I was that they were playing the damn tune, you know? And there it was. It's just great to still be able to catch that thrill.
So the big question is, lots of weed at that show? I'm guessing, you know, clouds billowing over the stage?
I got to tell you, it's, I mean, the Dead had huge party crowds too, and maybe I just don't remember, but we were sitting about two-thirds of the way back in the pavilion, and there were times looking up at the stage when the smoke was so thick I could not see through it. It just was huge billows of smoke coming up under the roof. And I know the Trey is pretty clean these days, but they certainly seem to be having a fun time up on stage and, you know, not minding the fact that all of this is going on. And another song that I didn't get to hear that certainly would have been fun under these circumstances, right, is Makasupa Policeman. Isn't that all about, he always makes cracks about weed and stuff like that when he's doing that tune. But yeah, it was a big party crowd. Everybody there was small. It was like pretty much everyone. It was one of the, you know, since it was the first time since the Dead show when I got to a concert with a bunch of my own weed and I never needed to smoke any of it.
Yeah, and the good news is unlike New York City, it's real weed. Yeah, so it's not like, not like what's happening right now, if you've been watching the news, where I think 20 of these fake weed trucks just got yanked off the streets in the last couple of days. And, you know, I don't know if anyone out there has been to New York City recently, but New York is just crammed full of these, quote, weed trucks, which aren't, you know, licensed dispensaries. They're not licensed by the state. They're not licensed by the city. And they've just started popping up. And, you know, some people think they're selling D8. Some people think they're just selling flat-out weed. They claim they're not selling anything that's got any psychoactive cannabinoids at all. But at this point, the city's had enough. And as of, you know, the last couple of days, they've gone out there and just started towing these guys, you know, some for parking fines and some just saying you guys are unlicensed retailers of cannabis products. So you're gone. I don't know if you've been seeing any of the same stuff happening in Chicago, but it's kind of crazy that New York has allowed this to get people to get away with this for so long before actually doing anything about it.
Yeah, Chicago, they regulate that too tightly. They need the money. They'd be on you in day one. And under, even selling hemp is complicated, right? Because while it's legal, you still have to let the people know you're doing it and get everybody's permission and all of that. But, you know, look, again, this is what happens, right? Isn't this the result? Like we've talked about in the past, we're now talking like, I mean, New York, they voted legal weed in. They voted adult use in. but it's not there yet. And while these programs struggle to get online, all these other people are running in to fill in the gaps while they can. And, you know, that's what these guys are doing.
And, the problem is the consumer doesn't know the difference, right? You know, the consumer sits there going, okay, well, I'm seeing weed out here. And it's like, they don't know who's a licensed retailer and who isn't. I mean, I've had friends like our mutual friend Dave Braniffman, you know, a couple of years ago was telling me at dinner one night that he went into a certain town and was like, you know, buying weed in Southern California. And the other guy and I at dinner were like, well, you know, there is no legal weed in that town. You went into a trap shop. And he's like, wait, what? But I thought I was supporting like the new industry, you know, the new legalized weed. So, and that's someone that works in the industry. That's someone that's pretty in tune with what's happening. But in New York City, you get a tourist that comes in. They go, oh, yeah, is weed legal in New York? And someone's like, oh, yeah, we legalized it. They're like, okay, I'll go over to that truck and buy something. You know, these guys are making an absolute killing over the ignorance of the general public as to, like, what's allowed and what's not. And they're calling their products the same name as everything else. You know, like, you can buy, like, you know, buds of Gary Payton, but it might not be the Gary Payton you have in California. It's, you know, what you're getting in New York, and it could be hemp. It could be something else sprayed with, you know, some sort of, like, fake cannabinoid. But there's got to be a bright line delineation.
What did P.T. Barnum say?
Yeah, sucker born every day, right? But in this case, I don't think they're suckers. I think there's a, you know, there's a misinformation gap.
No, they're just ill-informed.
Yeah, and then I think they have to, you know, display something that says, like, the way, like, Dutch coffee shops have that sticker on them that lets you know that they're actually legal. There should be something that allows people to say, okay, is this group, you know, a legally licensed cannabis retailer, and are they actually selling the product that I think I'm buying?
Well, I would say that that's on the state, but I think it's even more on the industry. The people in the industry who are out there, they have to step up and they have to call this out for what it is and, you know, and make us think about it, because it's their potential business that's getting taken away. And not only is it getting taken away, but it creates a negative buzz for the industry, and that doesn't help them at all. In fact, it hurts them. So, you know, it would be nice to see some cooperation among government and, you know, the bigger MSOs and some of the other successful parties out there, you know, to try and step in and push for those types of regulations. Because, look, there's, you know, New York is, how many times can you go to New York and buy a really expensive knockoff watch, a really expensive knockoff lady's purse, a really expensive knockoff anything, you know, and think you've just gotten the greatest deal in the world, so you go home and your local jeweler friend takes a look at that and says, you just got taken to the cleaners, right? And that's, New York City's famous for that. So, you know, maybe with weed too.
Well, to reference our next song clip from Autzen, you know, if I had my way, I'd burn all those fake retailers down. And so it's, you know, you gotta be careful about, you know, where you're buying. You gotta make sure you know what you're going after. So, but yeah, like, it's a crazy, interesting story that I know is not over yet. But, you know, maybe we get back to some Grateful Dead here for a minute. So, I mean, Dan, I queued up Samson as the next choice in here. And again, for a lot of the same reasons I did the Slipknot. And that's, you know, it's got some, you know, great ability to showcase the new Cripe guitar.
If I had my way, if I had my way.
It being Sunday, as Bobby would famously say. Yep.
You know it's a Sunday night with the Samson. Yep, 100%.
I always like the tune. I love the drums entering into the song. I love the energy with it. You know, it's there's probably some people who are like, you can only hear so many Samson and Delilahs, but I always find it enjoyable. And you know, Bobby always gives it good energy. And, you know, it's a fun story for those of us who went to Sunday school.
Yeah, look, in 1993, it's pretty rare to get a 10-song second set, right? And that's what we got this night with the helps of Franklin's, Samson, Ship of Fools, Karina, and then Out of Space, A Wheel, Miracle, Days Between, and then Not Fade Away before the Liberty Encore. So it was rare. You know, normally like second sets turn into like, you know, 6 or 7 songs max, but anytime you get a helps of Franklin's opener, you kind of expect it to tone down after that, and that's when you get the Ship of Fools. But it being Sunday, they dropped right into the Samson. Speaking of burning buildings down and sort of, did you see that Burner from Cookies is on the cover of Forbes magazine this month?
I did. Well, I hadn't, but when you sent the story over, I saw it. And hey, look, you know, marijuana guy's making it big, man. I love that. Forbes magazine, I mean, you know, hell, for God's sake, that's like, we're not talking about Rolling Stone. That is huge. That's big time. You know, that it's big time that they would want to feature somebody like that. And then it's big time to get to be the guy they feature.
Yeah, it's the first time they've actually put a weed CEO on the cover of Forbes the entire time they've had the magazine. So, you know, other publications have done it. As you said, Rolling Stone has done it, Newsweek's done it, you know, but Forbes is kind of more of a buttoned-up, respected publication. They've been great about following the cannabis industry for a while. You know, they certainly have two or three cannabis writers that are on staff at this point, my buddy Chris Crane being one of them, that, you know, writes to them pretty frequently. But the interesting thing I think I've thought about Burner being on the cover wasn't just, you know, the novelty of having a cannabis CEO on the cover, but it was the quote that he has on the cover of the magazine, which is, you know, it's hard to sell legal weed, which I thought was really interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people have this misconception that Burner actually sells weed, you know, because he is the face behind Cookies as a brand. But, you know, if you actually understand the Cookies contracts, Burner doesn't sell weed. Burner sells packaging. Burner sells a lifestyle. He sells, you know, the brand stuff. He sells a lot of apparel. And he licenses his name to, you know, different growers to be able to sell stuff that's packaged in his boxes, and they pay him for the privilege. So he takes, you know, a couple percent rake off of every product that's sold in the Cookies name. But he's never sold a legal bud in his life. Well, you know, never sold a legal bud, is I think accurate, as I said. But, you know, the perception is that he's probably the biggest seller of weed in America right now. And it's amazing to me that, again, the consumer knows so much less than the industry insiders of, like, you know, just the same way Willie Nelson doesn't sell weed and Garcia doesn't sell weed. You know, they license their name to people that sell weed with their likeness on it or with the, you know, their product name attached to it. But, you know, Burner's been really, really clever about how he's built this massive empire across, you know, probably 15 states at this point, using the Cookies brand name.
Very cool. It's just a big moment, and it's another milestone for the industry as it moves, you know, towards its path, you know, towards normalization. And, you know, it'll really be something when they feature somebody on the cover of the magazine for marijuana who's not otherwise already famous, right? You know, when they show like a Charlie Bachtel or a Ben Kovler or one of those guys, you know, and they're being featured for their celebrity status as, you know, the marijuana, you know, giants that they've grown into. And I suspect, you know, we'll get there as well. And, you know, that all of that will be celebrated in its own time, in its own way. But it's just nice to see. And, you know, I know a lot of people that would be reading that magazine and looking at that. My father, for instance. So, you know, I always makes me wonder what him or, you know, the guys in his generation, what they think when all of a sudden they see a respected business magazine playing around with all this marijuana stuff. But, I think it's a sign of the times.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, 10 years ago when you saw some of these magazines first covering, I remember the first time I was interviewed by Bloomberg, you know, the quotes that they gave me, you know, they were trying to bait me into silly things, you know, like, do you have any Art Crumb comics behind your counter at your shops? And I was sort of like, really, guys? Like, you know, you're trying to intentionally cheapen what it is that we do for a living and sort of poke fun at it. And you're trying to get that quote out of me to, you know, like, where my answer was like, is that even a real question? You know, it's like you can't really allow them to bait you into it. Whereas now the articles, actually the coverage about the industry is, you know, what's happening with your business? How'd you build the business? You know, what makes it exciting? It's no longer, you know, quietly mocking you from behind the scenes, expecting that you're not going to notice what it is they're trying to do. And again, I think journalists in general are great at doing that. They try to sensationalize everything because it sells more copy. But you know, that's why, you know, getting editorial control of the story you're featured in is usually important, because they can't paint the industry into a corner.
Well, not when you have an industry that, you know, in the last few years has had sales, you know, as high as 975 million or whatever these numbers are that, you know, some of these people are getting, you know, just these insane numbers that people are getting for selling off their, when they sell off their whole portfolio of licenses, right? I mean, and they can generate, when you have an industry that's generating that kind of money, you can't ignore it, right? I mean, the big commercial financial magazines and publications can't ignore that kind of money. They have to acknowledge that it's out there.
Without a doubt. I mean, obviously it's come down quite a bit recently, and, you know, we saw earnings week happen with all the publics. So it's not quite what it was, but, you know, revenue's still increasing. We're just waiting to see whether or not, you know, the next pop happens. But a lot of that is, you know, largely attributed to whether or not safe banking goes through. And, you know, we got some news out of that today as well that, you know, Cory Booker seems to be, you know, intentionally trying to kibosh SAFE in favor of trying to add additional provisions to it that would make it a bit more equity focused than it is today, which, again, I'm totally in favor of. And I think that, you know, social equity should be pushed more. And I love what just happened in Massachusetts that my friend Chanel Lindsay helped push through. But there's a lot of stuff that's happening on the equity front. I don't know if we want to derail the single most important piece of legislation to the industry right now over something that, you know, can be fixed retroactively or through a different piece of legislation. I understand that this might not go as far as Booker wants or as far as, you know, different groups in the industry want. But if you actually want to see the industry, you know, take off and actually have access to capital again and watch asset values start to rise, you've got to do something. And that something first is passing SAFE.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm a big fan of social equity. However, I'm not going to lie, I've become very disillusioned because I have yet to see a state, including Illinois, for all their talk about social equity, actually put together a true social equity plan that will achieve the goals that they're looking for. You know, and we don't have to sit here right now and go through all the problems with what some of these states have done, but it becomes a very complicated proposition, and that's because when you get into the issue of social equity, what I might deem to be equitable is certainly not something what somebody else might deem to be equitable. And if you're talking about people of color, you know, I'm sure they're going to come at it from a different perspective than you and I. I'm a big fan of social equity, and I would like to see it work if it can be made, you know, to work in on some level. But it's a process that's going to take time and is going to take a lot of input from people and a lot of patience and a lot of everything. And while all of that is going on, we need banking. We can't let banking be held hostage to these other issues. As much as we need to have social equity, without banking, the industry as a whole suffers anyway. If we're going to have social equity, I would think it would be great for the social equity owners to know that they can go down to their local neighborhood bank and be able to get money and not have to deal with third-party private lenders who will most likely offer terms far more, you know, outrageous than anything you could get from a bank if they were willing to do business with you.
Well, that's why I love the Massachusetts law that just, you know, got enacted. The one I was making reference to is it actually has a pool of capital set aside that, you know, applicants that meet the equity requirements can start tapping into, that, you know, they can finance through the state or, you know, what their build out's going to be. So you're not taking predatory lending and you're not essentially, you know, going all the cashes and being sucked right back out by the same people you're trying to avoid. So, you know, if you're really trying to empower people that have been prejudiced by the drug war, whether it's people of color or whether it's felons from nonviolent drug offenses, those people need a way to actually to access capital that's not going back to the same guys they're trying to prevent from just getting licenses in the first place. So it was really, you know, in many ways, the equity programs, we've talked about this before, have been, you know, largely sort of straw man operations anyway. But, you know, at this point, if you can actually put a pool of capital together to empower people to access the market, that's fantastic. But I don't think that necessarily needs to be done at the federal level. I love the fact that states are taking that in their own hands. So as you said, you know, please, Cory Booker, we need SAFE to go through. We don't need another delay on this. If we actually want to see the industry survive in a lot of states, access to capital, access to banking, access to the NASDAQ or the NYSE, all these things are critically important to our industry. And you know, yes, there are many other things that need to be fixed as well. But I'm a huge fan of incremental change, and right now we need to put up a W because the industry has been putting up a lot of L's for the last year and a half.
100%. And here's the, not to harp on social equity any more than we need to, but the biggest problem here, and this is what you just said a second ago, Rob, it has to be made available for the people who qualify for social equity, for the people of color, for the people who have been victims of the war on drugs, which in Illinois is defined as meaning you've been arrested. Not even convicted, you've been arrested for a marijuana offense. You know who gets arrested for marijuana offenses? The really, really rich white kids who live in, you know, the near north suburbs here, who go to the, you know, the public schools that are the really high-end public schools, and they all have access to marijuana at ridiculously young ages, and they all, one after another, at some point in time, get pinched for smoking a joint or having it in their car. All of a sudden, there's social equity under Illinois law, and this is what happened, at least in Illinois. They were so determined not to create social equity based solely on racial lines that they tried to come up with something that they figured the odds would just put more of those types of people in. But because anyone could qualify for social equity, you had to, otherwise you had no chance of getting a license. So people would go out, either bring in a straw man or, hey, I was busted when I was 15. I'm going to fall back and rely on that. And that's why social equity doesn't work, because we leave openings that allow the people we're trying to not get all the licenses still step in and get all the licenses. You know, I think some of the MSOs have even worked with, you know, social equity candidates for purposes of trying to get, you know, more licenses. And I'm not here to criticize them or to praise them for it one way or the other. All I'm saying is that if we really want to have social equity, we have to sit down and we have to really define what social equity is. And we have to say, we're going to have a group of people who clearly qualify as social equity under anyone's definition. It doesn't just have to be based on race, but it should be based on race. It should be based on finance. It should be based on a lot of different things. And then say, we're going to give out 70 licenses, 75 licenses, 25 of them are going to go to the people in this pool who are social equity candidates, and all the other people will compete on their own level for the other 50 licenses. And then you know 25 of the licenses are going to go to social equity people, but they won't do that. You know, and they play this game that, oh, well, we can't do that. We can't just do it based on race. That would be, you know, unconstitutional or, you know, violation. And don't do it that way, but you can break it down in enough ways. But, you know, when it's Illinois, the first question is, well, they didn't want to break it down this way because these are all the big contributors, and so they want to set it up so that anybody can step in, you know, and can get those licenses. And they've done a very bad job of trying to convince people otherwise.
Yeah, it's definitely not a problem we're going to fix overnight, but I really wish they wouldn't be trying to fix it while SAFE is so close to being passed. And by all accounts, you know, SAFE should go through this year and it should be signed into law. And if it is, you know, again, it's not, you know, we talked about this before, that I don't know whether or not that's going to mean the banks are going to participate, but it at least allows them to if they so choose. So it's a heck of a lot further along than we are right now. So we will see, and let's watch this one closely. And, you know, I'd love to get a chance to speak to some of the people that are on the left that are, you know, strong advocates for cannabis legalization, but at the same time, only under certain parameters where it's got to meet their definition of, you know, going far enough to include certain provisions they want, which, by the way, I agree with those provisions 100%, but not to the exclusion of losing the bill completely. You know, like you can't let a bill die because you're pushing it too far.
And look, that's a classic Washington, D.C. tactic, right? A bill's going through, we're going to go tack on 50 other things, you know, and try and do it that way. The answer is no, absolutely not. Financing in this industry, it will... If we get the SAFE Act passed, it will benefit social equity people in a way that they're not currently benefited. It will give them the opportunity to go into a neighborhood bank like any other business and try and get a loan to be able to compete in the industry in which they've now been given a license. And to you know, right, if we know that if there's no banking, the rich guys still have people they can go and get their money from. The social equity people, not so much. So I don't think that's a very well thought out strategy.
No, I agree.
One other little thing I just want to throw in there. I'm not a resident of the state of New York, but for those of you who are, the New York State Fair is going to allow people to smoke marijuana in the designated smoking areas this year. And reading the article about it, it's as though the only issue is where are you smoking it, not the fact that people are smoking marijuana in public. And I love that. Right? All the quotes are like, well, we don't want to have to, we understand people are going to want to smoke, but we don't want people to be encouraged to smoke around families and kids. So we're going to give them their own separate area where they can go and smoke. Now, 99% of the time, if you're at a state fair and you walk into a smoking area, it's cigarettes or tobacco only. They don't expand it enough to say, hey, you guys who want to smoke THC, go right ahead. But now they're giving you the green light. And I got to say, you know, if you go to one of those things and you get busted walking around the fair smoking, you're a moron. You know, if you can't take 10 minutes to go off to one of those areas and sit there and smoke what you want to smoke and then go back and take care of business, you know, good for them. Hats off to New York. I love that.
Yeah, it sounds like the Plessy v. Ferguson cannabis question. Separate but equal. You know, it's
yes.
We can keep you
right.
We can keep you away from everyone, but you know, you're allowed to smoke, just not over here. You know, but you're fine. Look, you know, we watched California already do it with outside lands, but people find anything that's combustible offensive. I mean, look, I find cigarette smoke offensive. I've got no problems with separating cigarette smokers away from the crowd because I don't really want to be around it. If there's people that find cannabis smoke offensive, look, fine. I get it. If you want to put, you know, a little bit of distance between us, that's great. The better part is, can you actually at least, you know, consume cannabis on New York State public grounds property? And that's where, you know, like, Well, I'm waiting to see whether or not Kathy Hochul steps in and says, wait a second, guys, there's a law against, you know, consuming on any, New York public lands. So I find it interesting that the fair has said yes. I'm just curious whether or not the state then comes back and says no, because it still violates another law that, you know, we either have to create some sort of a carve out for it, or we need to figure out a way to amend. But as of right now, I think there's a conflict in law between, you know, what can be done, what can't, if it's on state lands.
I think you're absolutely right. And look, it's just wonderful, right? I completely agree that all smoking should be separated. You know, the worst thing is, you know, even at the fish show, you know, since everybody's smoking anyway, they're not going to come in and try and enforce non-smoking rules. And I love all the smoking until the person in front of you lights up a cigarette and does the old holds it on the side thing. Right. When I was 5 or 10 years old, I wanted to lean over to the person and say, why don't you hold it in front of your own face? Why are you holding it in front of my face? But yeah, I mean, I still have a knee-jerk reaction to tobacco smoke, too. So I imagine people have the same kind of reaction to marijuana smoke. That's great. Just give us a place. Right. I don't think anybody's going to care unless it's like some really gross place they're sending you off to. But just the idea that you can go and do it is a wonderful, wonderful thing. And that's going to really be a lot of fun. So looking forward to that.
Yeah. I agree. By the way, you know, the Dead used to always play, when they used to play in Oregon for years, it was in a county fairground. It was always in Vineta County Fairgrounds. And, you know, I'm guessing nowadays that Vineta, you'd be able to smoke cannabis no problems, just the same way you can at outside lands in San Francisco and Golden Gate Park. But I don't know if you could have on the University of Oregon's campus at Autzen Stadium. So, you know, I know I asked before the show, Larry, if you've ever been to Autzen. Autzen was right in the middle of campus at University of Oregon. Now, I can tell you that, you know, Oregon probably consumes more cannabis per pound, you know, pound for pound than any other state in America. And I think Eugene probably, I would put Eugene up against any city in America as far as cannabis consumption. You know, it was for years, not just great football players coming out of that school, but it was a ton of hippies coming out of that school. And I had more fun in that city, or I shouldn't even call it a city, that large town for years, than almost anywhere else that, you know, when the Grateful Dead decided to play there. Again, I was, you know, delighted, and it's one of the most fun places. Like, I'm not a huge stadium show fan, but when you do a small stadium like Folsom Field in Boulder, or Autzen Stadium at U of O, it's a totally different vibe. It's kind of like, you know, you might not like indoor arenas, but then you go to Hampton and you're like, okay, you know, I get it. You know, there's some places that work, before we, you know, sort of end all the stuff we're doing on the show today, The key reason I picked this show, outside of the coolness factor of Autzen and the coolness of, like, you know, the new guitar, was there's one highlight from that night that, you know, I talked to you about, and I don't think a lot of people know about, which is that they opened that night with a Jack Straw. And in the Jack Straw, Weir was having a lot of problems with his Stratocaster. And he kept trying to get it to work, and it kept not working, and he got really frustrated. You could see him on stage visibly upset that his guitar wasn't working. And he kept going back to his stack and trying to work with it and trying to, like, get his text to work with it. And finally, right before the jam started, he kind of just had enough, and he just storms off, just walks off stage. And he does it right as the jam was starting. And doesn't come back. And Garcia goes into the jam and just starts going for it, I think expecting that Weir would get back before, you know, they came back into St. Jack's Straw from Wichita, you know, for the sort of the crescendo portion of it. And Weir just doesn't come back. So you've got, I think it's a 3 minute and 40 something second jam of Garcia just going solo. And, you know, I can't think of another time that I saw the Dead where I actually got to see, you know, Garcia be the sole guitar player up on stage, especially during a jam. It'd be one thing if it was, like, you know, during verses of, like, let's say, like, a Peggio, you know, and Weir walks off and it's like this nice, quiet, sort of slow tempo, like, looping. But this was like full tilt Jack Straw jam with a brand new guitar and just crushing it. And rumor has it that backstage, when Weir went back there, he was so pissed off that he smashed his guitar to bits. Now, whether or not that's true, I've heard rumors of people that, you know, because it's a stadium show, people that could actually see into the backstage area from, you know, the far side of the stadium. So allegedly, there's a lot of rumors out there that it's true. And then he came back out playing a different guitar that still had some tech issues. But the good part about it is arguably, I'd say it's definitely the best Jack Straw jam of the 90s, and arguably one of the best Jack Straw jams of all time. And if you look it up on, like, Heady version, it's certainly the one that from, like, the 90s gets, you know, way more, you know, thumbs up votes. But did you get a chance to listen to this one before the show?
I did. It's very exciting, and I'm excited to share it with everyone. You're right. It gives them a very noticeably different sound, when it's just, and quite frankly, I think that's a tribute to Weir, really. You know, that's not designed to be a backhanded, you know, compliment. That's a tribute to Weir, because what we're not hearing is all of the little fillers and all the things that he normally puts in there. And although Garcia's playing is beautiful, it really highlights the extra that Bob Weir brings to the band. And, you know, in that respect, it's kind of cool.
Prime example of something that you always complain about, which is you don't know where, you know, to play. You know, like it's really hard to keep it to 30 seconds or 40 seconds, you know, in something that's so good. I could have played that entire jam, and that jam stays that hot the entire 3 minutes and 40 seconds they play it. So anyone out there that hasn't heard the 8:22:93 Autzen Jack Straw, you know, go back and listen to it. And as you said, it's not a poke at Bob Weir. It's more the fact that, you know, Garcia was able to hold it down. Because, I mean, I would say the best Jack Straw is definitely have Weir all the way through. But this is such a unique thing because the jam is so much longer. Normally a Jack Straw jam, you know, clocks it like a minute and 30, a minute and 40 if it's, you know, a big one. But to go for 3:40 of just, you know, sort of the hottest part of the song, it's just such a rarity. And as I said, I don't think it was on purpose. It was more that Garcia's just waiting for Weir to come back. And it's like, all right, well, if he's not here, I'm just going to keep going.
And, you know, thank God that he did. It's look, you know, over the years, they've all had their, we were talking about the show a few weeks ago when Jerry couldn't come out and Brent was playing the keyboards to fill in, you know, Jerry's guitar parts and stuff. And it's wonderful to see. And it's, you know, not unlike, well, a little bit unlike, you know, but it gives it the same kind of sound that you have with Fish. With one lead guitar player, a bass player, a drummer, a keyboard, right? And Fish is so Trey forward with all of his guitar solos and everything. And listening to Jerry there, it, you know, you get that unique kind of solo guitar sound. And again, not to smash Weir, but it's just fun to have the opportunity to hear it once or twice like that.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of that, I don't know if you realize, but Trey actually might have another guitar player on stage with him pretty soon. If you saw the announcement of the collaboration between the Trey Band and Goose, that's going to happen for, I think, 8 shows this fall. Did you see the commercial that they put out about it? The peanut butter and chocolate commercial?
I have not seen the commercial.
So it's fantastic. Trey's holding chocolate, and Goose's lead guy is holding a thing of peanut butter, and they did the old Reese's commercial from the 1970s. They bump into each other, and it's like, hey, you got your chocolate, my peanut butter. No, you got your peanut butter, my chocolate. And then, like, yeah, that's great. And it's like Trey and Goose together. Well, I don't know if you saw it, but Reese has actually put out a tweet today about it, which is really, really funny. And it said, we won't say whether we love chocolate, Trey Anastasio, or peanut butter, Goose the band more. But speaking from experience, we 100% endorse this collaboration. Our question is, will you make us split open and melt? If so, we might need to step into the freezer. which is great that Reese is obviously someone in their marketing
department, or in their
social media department, who's a Fish fan. But it's just fantastic that Reese's came out and put that out immediately after these guys dropped a blatant ripoff of an old Reese's ad.
Absolutely. No, I like that. Well, clearly there is something about Goose that has smitten Trey, and he's very taken by them. You know, everybody's talking about the video clips of him going out and playing a few tunes with them, and, you know, whatever his reasoning is, he loves them, and that's great. You know what? More power to him, more power to Goose. I'm going to see Goose a couple of weeks at Sacred Rose. I've never seen Goose before. Very excited. It's going to be a big night for me. I've never seen Humphreys McGee. I've never seen Disco Biscuits. I've never seen a lot of bands I'm going to finally get to see.
How have you? Yeah. Really? Wow, you've never seen Humphreys? You live in Chicago?
Yep.
How is that possible?
I just never did.
Wow, I mean, Umphs to me is like, you know, when if you said, like, name a Chicago band, like, who do you think of as, like, you know, Chicago? I would, you know, name, like, all the old blues guys. I'd name the Blues Brothers. But, I mean, if you say, like, contemporary, like, name Chicago, it's Umphrey's 100% for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got buddies who have seen him 100 times. It's just I've never wound up going to one of their shows. And actually, even at the Sacred Rose, it's going to be complicated because they have a – Umphrey's plays their first set, and then Goose's two-hour set starts. So, you know, everybody's like, oh, yeah, we'll go catch the first set of Umphrey's, then we'll go catch Goose and just listen to them all the way through because you can't miss Goose. So I was like, okay, fine, I'll do it like that.
Are they on the same stage?
No. No. So Umphrey's will be doing their first set over here, and then by the time the first set is over, Goose will start their 2 hours. They're just doing 1 2-hour set over there, and in the middle of their 2-hour set, Umphrey's is playing their second set.
Gotcha. Well, I'm not sure who I'd rather go see. I've never seen Goose, but I've seen Umphrey's, you know, probably 40 plus times now. And yeah, I've seen some just ridiculously good shows those guys put on. I think, you know, when you think of like the 1-2 guitar punch, you know, the classic, you know, 1-2 guitarists of, like, you know, Dwayne Allman with Dickie Betts, or, you know, you think about
Jerry and Bobby.
I wouldn't put Bobby as, like, you know, someone that's, you know, that good as a lead. You know, it's rare you get two lead guitar players in the same band.
Guitar players, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like, I think Mo has it, you know, with Al Shire and Chuck Garvey. You know, those guys, like, both of them, like, were just blistering hot, you know, guitar players. But Jake Singer and Brendan Bayless, who have two totally different styles, but are just, you know, incredibly talented. Umphrey's, I think, has a 1-2 punch for guitar players is as good as it can, where those guys can just trade back and forth, back and forth, back and forth the whole time with totally different styles. And, like, they're much more, I mean, I think they consider themselves to be more prog rock than jam bandy. And, you know, their style, like, I'm not a huge fan of all their songs as far as, you know, like, their singing, but, you know, purely from a musical standpoint, I don't think there's too many guys in the business right now that are better than Umphrey's.
Yeah, well, I look forward to seeing them. It's going to be a fun weekend for me to, you know, to catch up on a lot of bands and still see some of the standards. Phil Lesh on Friday night with the Wilco Boys and Carl Denson ought to be just amazing. And, Sunday night, J-Rad is closing out that night, and they're bumping up against a lot of good players too. But I've seen J-Rad, I'm going to go check out other bands. No. If J-Rad is playing and I'm there, I'm going to J-Rad, definitely. And so it'll be fun, you know.
I am terribly jealous. You're killing the music this summer, Larry. You're absolutely crushing the music this summer. Like, I haven't had a summer like you've described, like, you know, for this year in years. So, you know, way to get after it, man.
It's been a great summer. I owe a lot to a lot of good buddies. My good buddy Alex is always taking us to great shows. My buddy Kevin got me up to the Fish shows. You know, always good people out there supporting me. And now a lot of this whole crew is coming into Chicago. So it'll be great, a chance to hang out with everybody, go see live music, and not have to worry about my playing being delayed. So very excited about that. And I'm sure it's going to be a great weekend. And we'll be talking all about that in the aftermath as well, and having some rundown on what went down at Sacred Rose.
I'm a firm believer at this point that that Alex Wellens is the Bob Sacramento of the Deadhead Cannabis Show. He's the person you always hear about, but you never actually get to see. You're like Wilson in Tool Time. You know, like, you think he exists, but you're not sure.
Okay, well, we're bringing him on one of these days, maybe after Sacred Rose, and he can give his official report on that. But
hey, the only reason I believe you at all is I've met his wife.
Okay, well, there's, you know, look, Andy's right there, and she knows all this. In fact, they just saw Phil Lesh just did a show out by them in the Bay Area somewhere, a free show that they were able to even walk to, and they were telling me all about it, and, you know, giving great raves on that. And you know, they're very, very musically inclined. They're as tied into the musical scene as anyone I know, and I'm just lucky to get to go along for the ride. So it always works out well for me.
Well, I gotta tell you, Larry, it's nice to be back. It's nice to be doing the show again. I'm super excited for the next couple of weeks now that I'm back in a stable environment with a real internet connection and air conditioning in the house and not traveling. And so it's I'm back to my regular routine of very much looking forward to taping the Deadhead Canvas show with you. So, you know, thanks for holding it down this summer, and especially doing it in between what sounds to be like thousands of different shows you've been hitting. So, you know, mighty impressed you've been able to keep up the furious pace of seeing music and talking about music. So, good on you, man.
Okay. Got to be able to do it, right? The music's there if we don't take advantage of it. And after the last two summers of just not really feeling like you know, it was okay this summer, even though I know there's still stuff going around. It was just, got to get out and start seeing live music. And I will add that it helped that this was the year that we all turned 60, my whole group of friends. You know, for us, it was, for those of you who grew up in that type of environment, it was like bar mitzvah year, right? Either as a parent or a child, when every weekend there's another bar mitzvah that you have to go to, your kid has to go to. And, you know, by the end of the year, you're just exhausted. And this is, we've all turned 60. And as we've all turned 60, we've had destination get-togethers. And they've all involved music on one level or another. And that's just been, a great addition to all of it, too. And, we decided, well, you turn 60, it's a great milestone to celebrate. And we're finally at the age where we can actually do it. And we still don't have kids in the house that we have to worry about and, you know, get coverage for. And they're all old enough to manage for themselves for, you know, a few weekends during the year while the parents all run out and, you know, get together and do what we like to do.
No doubt. Well, just because I'm not out there seeing as much as you are, I can tell you that my love will not fade away. So it's I'm listening to as much as I can here at the house and just not seeing it live, but getting as much as I can and just taking in whatever's being put out for me to consume, just doing it at home instead of in an audience. But, very, very stoked. So,
well, and that's a great little bit of foreshadowing for us there.
Yeah, and so until next week, we'll see you then and enjoy the last little clip we have from Autzen Stadium, August 22nd, 1993.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week. Be safe, have fun, enjoy your cannabis responsibly.